U.S. Supreme Court ruled for the first time that former presidents have broad immunity from prosecution.
I think this is a remarkably sweeping opinion that upends assumptions that we have had for almost 250 years about nobody being above the law. I find it shocking, and frankly, I find it terrifying.
Hurricane Beryl rips through the Southeast Caribbean.
Honestly, have not seen any recorded storms perform such an intensification rate prior to September 1st in the history books.
And documenting McDonald's restaurant's global history in photos and words.
Checking in from the largest McDonald's in the Philippines, the base of Mount Fuji, Amsterdam, Las Vegas, Nevada, Lindvallen, Sweden, Yangshuo, Singapore.
Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. A groundbreaking decision from the U.S. Supreme Court.
The president has absolute immunity for actions that are within the core of his constitutional functions.
That's Joel Paul, a professor of law at the University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco. That's sort of mind-boggling.
It is more than mind-boggling. It is contrary to everything in our history up to this point.
The Supreme Court on Monday ruled for the first time that former presidents have broad immunity from prosecution, extending the delay in the Washington criminal case against Donald Trump on charges he plotted to overturn the 2020 presidential election loss, all but ending prospects the former president could be tried before the November election. In a historic 6-3 ruling, the court's conservative majority, including the three justices appointed by Trump, narrowed the case against him and returned it to the trial court to determine what is left of special counsel Jack Smith's indictment.
There's never been a court holding that says that the president does not have immunity. So it's not that the court has overruled something that was already there. There haven't been criminal prosecutions of former presidents in the past either. So in that sense, this is an unprecedented situation on both sides.
That's Professor Carolyn Shapiro, the founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways that are, I think, go far beyond anything that anybody could have assumed or anticipated. For example, the court says that the motive for what the president does is not relevant in determining whether or not there's an official act. So if the president conspires with Justice Department officials to throw an election, because talking to Justice Department officials is part of an official act, is generally an official act, the fact that he's doing it for corrupt and criminal reasons is not relevant, and it's still, and he still will have immunity.
So the first thing that popped into my head was, so Nixon calls the FBI and says, don't investigate Watergate.
Right.
Is not illegal under this ruling.
Yes. I mean, the remarkable thing about this ruling, one of the remarkable things about this ruling, is that it suggests that Nixon's pardon was superfluous. Because basically what Nixon did was he told people who worked for him to commit a crime. But he communicated that within his constitutional authority as president, and therefore the court would say, I assume, that he had absolute immunity.
Before this ruling, Nixon's actions would have been considered obstruction of justice.
We would have. Yes. I mean, it would be, we would care about the intent behind the motivation behind the call. Was it part of a criminal cover-up, or was it because the Nixon believed somehow that it was in the interests of the country, or that this was a misguided investigation in some sincere way? Those distinctions are gone. The ability to, I mean, when, you know, Nixon said, when the president does it, it's not illegal. And that was seen as a shocking thing to say. It now appears that he may have been right under the current Supreme Court.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by fellow liberal justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson, delivered a sharply worded dissent, saying the ruling effectively creates a law-free zone around the president when he uses his official powers in any way, under the majority's reasoning, he now will be insulated from criminal prosecution. Once again, Joel Paul, a professor of law at the University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco.
The Constitution has no language in it that affords the president any immunity. In fact, the impeachment clause in the Constitution expressly states that the president can be prosecuted criminally for actions that he undertakes after he is impeached. If the court were correct in its reading of the Constitution, it would suggest that even after being impeached, the president couldn't be criminally prosecuted for those things that are within his core presidential functions. So if the president orders the military to have a coup or tells them FBI to go out and assassinate his political rivals, this court suggests by this opinion that it would fall within his absolute immunity because he's communicating with the people who work for him. And that seems contrary to the very principle that no man is against the law, no man is above the law.
The thing that's most curious about this decision by the conservative justices is that they claim to be traditionalists, arguing that they only make decisions based on what's written in the Constitution and based on history and previous court decisions. Professor Carolyn Shapiro, the founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes, the conservative justices, most of them, claim to be originalists, which is to say that they look to what they would call the original public meaning of the Constitution at the time it was written and ratified, or the specific amendments at the time they were written and ratified, and they rely on that what they can deduce from that history and also from tradition. So they look to what has been part of our system for a long time to determine the meaning of the Constitution. Now, they make claims about how this leads to a certain amount of constraint on judges and justices. They make claims about this being the most sensible way to engage in constitutional interpretation. Those are highly contestable claims. But in this case, they didn't even try to do that. In this case, Justice Sotomayor lays out the history and lays out the history that shows that the framers would have been aghast at something like this. They did not want to have a king. We just fought a revolution to get away from a king. And the majority has really nothing to say about it. They just kind of say, well, yeah, there's some evidence there, but it's kind of a wash, and then they move on. They engage in no meaningful historical analysis at all. So that's, I think, a big part of her accusation.
President Biden weighed in a live speech to the nation Monday night.
The presidency is the most powerful office in the world. It's an office that not only tests your judgment, perhaps even more importantly, it's an office that tests your character. Because you not only face moments when you need the courage to exercise the full power of the presidency, You also face moments where you need the wisdom to respect the limits of the power of the office of the presidency. This nation was founded on the principle that there are no kings in America. Each of us is equal before the law. No one is above the law, not even the President of the United States. With today's Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity, that fundamentally changed. For all practical purposes, today's decision almost certainly means that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do. This is a fundamentally new principle, and it's a dangerous precedent, because the power of the office will no longer be constrained by the law, even including the Supreme Court of the United States.
Biden then turned to Donald Trump.
Nearly 4 years ago, my predecessor sent a violent mob to the U.S. Capitol to stop the peaceful transfer of power. We all saw it with our own eyes. We sat there and watched it happen that day. Attack on the police, the ransacking of the Capitol, a mob literally hunting down the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, gallows erected to hang the Vice President, Mike Pence. I think it's fair to say it's one of the darkest days in the history of America. Now the man who sent that mob to the U.S. Capitol is facing potential criminal conviction for what happened that day. And the American people deserve to have an answer in the courts before the upcoming election. The public has a right to know the answer about what happened on January 6th before they asked to vote again this year. Now, because of today's decision, that is highly, highly unlikely. It's a terrible disservice to the people of this nation.
The Supreme Court's ruling in former President Donald Trump's 2020 election interference case makes it all but certain that the Republican will not face trial in Washington ahead of the November election. The court did not dismiss the indictment, alleging Trump illegally schemed to cling to power after his loss to President Biden, but the ruling still amounts to a major victory for the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, whose legal strategy in all his criminal cases has focused on delaying the proceedings until after the election. The Trump legal team is also moving to have his New York hush money trial verdict overturned based on the immunity ruling. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. We're following these other stories from around the world. The Netherlands will supply Ukraine with the first of 24 promised F-16 fighter jets soon. The Netherlands has been one of the driving forces behind an international coalition to supply Ukraine with F-16s. Panama's new president, José Raúl Molina, took office on Monday, vowing to reactivate the economy and put the brakes on illegal immigration coming through the Central American nation's southern jungle. The Brazilian Amazon recorded 13,489 wildfires in the first half of this year, the worst figure in 20 years, the total up 61% compared with the 8,300 fires from the same period last year. An increase that experts say is the result of a historic drought that struck the world's largest tropical rainforest last year. After weeks of political deal-making, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced the cabinet of his new government of national unity. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg that ministers from different parties will now have to put political differences aside to run the country successfully.
South Africa's new ministers are a diverse group, from a former armed robber to a white Afrikaner nationalist. After the long-governing African National Congress, or ANC, lost its majority in May elections, Ramaphosa opted to form an inclusive government with 10 opposition parties that don't necessarily see eye to eye. Ramaphosa had to divvy up cabinet positions to keep everyone happy, with the result a somewhat bloated government of 32 ministers and 43 deputy ministers.
The establishment of the Government of National Unity in its current form is unprecedented in the history of our democracy.
Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. The Israeli army has ordered a mass evacuation of Palestinians from much of Gaza's second-largest city, Khan Yunis. Associated Press correspondent Joe Fetterman.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
Monday's evacuation call covered the entire eastern half of Khan Yunis and a large swath of the Gaza Strip's southeast corner. The third UN conference on Afghanistan is concluded in Doha. Joining us now from Doha is VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief, Sarah Zaman. So I realize that this process is moving forward at a glacial pace because it's a extremely difficult topic to maneuver. But so we're not really expecting anything, is what I'm saying, to come out of this conference like, oh, we got this or we got that. But in a bigger picture, longer term, what is the United Nations trying to do here with the Taliban?
So these talks are basically a product of an assessment that the UN did. And the result of the assessment was that basically there needs to be structured engagement with Afghanistan. And what that basically means is that the global community must get together and decide together in a practical manner about how to move forward with Afghanistan, where the Taliban's hardline government has not been recognized. And it's coming up on 3 years in August. Afghanistan, when you listen to the Taliban, their demands are that their frozen assets must be released, that there shouldn't be any difficulty for people to do business outside of Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan's banks don't really face any sanctions, but the banking system is largely cut off because Western banks don't really want to do business with Afghan banks because of the reputational risk that they offer and also because of just the financial risk that is involved. On the other hand, the basic problem that the Afghan Taliban government is completely not flexible at all when it comes to women's education, girls' education, women's, you know, their right to have mobility, to have access to public spaces. So certain parts have become very difficult to move on. Now, a Western diplomat that I was speaking to today, and he spoke to me on background, said that it's not as if the donor countries are using girls' rights as a bargaining chip. That is not something that they want to do. But they still want to see the Taliban make some kind of progress on issues that matter to Western countries, that matter to the larger global community.
Sarah Zaman, VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief in Doha, thanks again for joining us with that update from the conference.
Thank you for having me.
Hurricane Beryl strengthened as it churned toward the Caribbean's Windward Islands on Monday, threatening devastating flooding and storm surges as life-threatening high winds picked up speed. Hurricane Beryl is the first hurricane to reach Category 4 this early in the season. And Christopher Rozoff, an atmospheric scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, said the speed at which it strengthened is something they've never seen before this early in the year.
It had a very intense shift in intensity from a Category 1 to Category 4 storm in less than 24 hours, making it one of the most impressive rapid intensification cases in Atlantic history. And we honestly have not seen any recorded storms perform such an intensification rate prior to September 1st in the history book. So for a storm to do this in late June is something we have not seen before.
Communications are down on the island, so news about conditions there aren't available at the time of this show. The storm is on path to hit Jamaica, where warnings have now been issued. And finally,
it is the largest restaurant chain in the world. Whenever it adds a menu item, it kind of changes or moves markets.
That's New York photographer and writer Gary He. He has single-handedly documented McDonald's evolution over the last 40 years in his new book, McAtlas.
Checking in from the largest McDonald's in the Philippines, the base of Mount Fuji, Amsterdam, Lindvallen, Sweden, Yangshuo, Singapore, Porto, Portugal, Melbourne, Australia, Rotterdam, the Champs-Élysées McDonald's in Paris, France, Gyeongju, South Korea.
The seed of McAtlas was sown during a 2019 visit to a McDonald's in Marrakesh, where he experienced the meal that breaks the fast during Ramadan. The encounter sparked the realization that if McDonald's had to adapt its menu in Morocco, it must have done so elsewhere. This led to his comprehensive research on the world's largest restaurant chain, culminating in this book.
I visited McDonald's on 6 continents, 55 countries, maybe a couple more that are not in there, but the information kind of works their way into the text. And I must have had hundreds, if not thousands, of meals. I also photographed hundreds of items that are not available in the United States that McDonald's has sort of brought onto menus in these localized markets.
McAtlas will be released in November and is currently available for pre-sale. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platforms, online at voanews.com, and download our apps from Google and Apple. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently released the State Department's 2024 Trafficking in Persons Report, which examines government's efforts to combat human trafficking through prosecuting traffickers, protecting victims, and prevention. Around the globe, an estimated 27 million people are exploited for labor, services, and commercial sex. Through force, fraud, and coercion, they are made to toil in fields and factories, in restaurants and residences. Traffickers prey on some of the world's most marginalized and vulnerable individuals, profiting from their plight. The theme of this year's report examines the challenges associated with digital technology and how it has created new opportunities for traffickers to exploit individuals for profit, said Cindy Dyer, ambassador at large to monitor and combat trafficking in persons. This year's report also highlights the intersection between forced marriage and human trafficking and forced labor in Cuba's labor export program. We also highlight key human trafficking issues in the Western Hemisphere, said Ambassador Dyer.
Unprecedented irregular migration affects many Western Hemisphere countries, including the United States. We encourage governments to prevent trafficking and prioritize screening among migrants, who often assume debts to pay migrant smugglers and are then vulnerable to trafficking when they are unable to repay the money.
Unfortunately, some governments are part of the trafficking problem, said Ambassador Dyer.
This year, the secretary determined 13 countries exhibited a policy or pattern of trafficking. Belarus rejoined this list, and Sudan was newly added to the list, while several other governments, including Cuba, the PRC, and Russia, remained on the list from previous years.
Another troubling trend highlighted in this year's report is the coercive or fraudulent recruitment of fighters for Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Russian authorities, middlemen, private military companies or Russian-affiliated forces reportedly used coercion, deception, and in some cases force in the recruitment of foreign nationals. On a more positive note, total prosecutions of traffickers and convictions were up overall, and victim identification reached the highest level ever, said Ambassador Dyer.
For the third consecutive year, there was notable progress to combat labor trafficking, with labor trafficking convictions and victim identifications substantially increasing from last year to reach their highest levels ever.
The United States is proud to work alongside its partners at home and abroad to protect the vulnerable and prevent more individuals from being sucked into the underworld of human trafficking.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.